From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we present the first of three installments from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled, In the Bible, Ezekiel and His Vision of Our Time. Introducing Professor Wiesel is Boston University President Robert Brown.
To the members of the Greater Boston community who are joining us tonight, I'd like to welcome you to Boston University campus. And to all of you who are present this evening, thank you for coming to hear the first of the three public lectures which will be given over the coming weeks by Professor Elie Wiesel. Tonight I stand before you with a mixture of pride and sadness. Pride because it is my privilege to introduce Elie Wiesel, and sadness because I am doing so in place of John Silber, who traditionally has introduced Professor Wiesel at the first of his three annual lectures. As I am sure most of you know, Dr. Silber passed away just a little over 2 weeks ago. I'm honored to stand in his place and to introduce a man he recruited to the faculty of Boston University nearly four decades ago. John Silber's legacy at Boston University encompasses so many aspects of the university today, but no contributions were more important than showing us the value of outstanding faculty members. Faculty members who are wonderful teachers, but also scholars of national and international renown. None epitomizes these qualities more than Elie Wiesel. Since 1976, Professor Wiesel has been the Andrew W. Mellon Professor in the Humanities, and he's held the title of University Professor with appointments in both the Department of Philosophy and the Department of Religion. He is known and respected throughout the world for his body of literary work, for his tireless efforts on behalf of oppressed people, and for his work to defend human rights and promote peace around the world. He's done more than any other person to put light onto the darkest chapter of man known as the Holocaust. And we pray that through his efforts and the efforts of others inspired by him, we can make good on the promise of never again. His awards and honors for his writings and his work on behalf of humanity are too numerous to list, as are the more than 40 books he has produced since beginning with Night in 1958. Most notable, perhaps, is the recognition of the 1986 Nobel Prize for Peace. And given that this is October and we're in Boston, I have to mention one other slightly less significant honor that was thrust upon Professor Wiesel, only shortly after being announced as the 1986 Laureate in Peace. He received a call from Peter Uberoff, the commissioner of Major League Baseball. The World Series was about to commence, featuring the New York Mets against the Boston Red Sox, and the commissioner was calling to invite Elie to throw out the ceremonial first pitch at one of the games at Shea Stadium. He declined the offer to do so at the first game because it was a religious holiday, and at the second game was to be played on the Sabbath. But Uberoff was persistent. He checked with the rabbi and determined that a limousine and a police escort could pick up Professor Wiesel and his family after sunset and get him to the ballpark on time without violating any religious principles. And thus, Elie Wiesel became the first Nobel Peace Prize laureate to throw a pitch out at a World Series game. And for this, he got his picture in Sports Illustrated. We have no baseball in Boston this October, as is the case of most Octobers. But we are blessed to have Elie Wiesel. As a teacher, Professor Wiesel has led the students in his courses to explore themes of human interaction and understanding, using breadth of literature ranging from biblical texts to contemporary fiction. Tonight, Elie will do so for us, exploring fundamental issues in his lecture this evening entitled, In the Bible, Ezekiel and His Vision of Our Time. Please join me in welcoming Professor Wisok.
President Brown, that you should tell a story about baseball and me in it. Really, I had hoped to forget it. Because in truth, I did have to do it, because my son heard the story while I was on the telephone saying no to the commissioner. He said, "Dad, if you refuse, I will be the laughing stock in my classroom." For my son. So he taught me how to pitch once and the only time in my life. But President Brown, I hope that this endeavor that both of us will share the stage will be followed by many more. And we cannot, of course, and must not on this occasion not remember your predecessor, whom you mentioned, who for several decades led this institution, whose destiny has remained and will remain for decades now in your good hands. In Dr. Silber's last letter to me, he said that he was going to die. He knew it. I received it on the day of his funeral. 3 days later. He has given almost his entire life to Boston University. It really is now fortunate and proud to be led by you, President Brown. And you will lead it to ever greater heights, because this is one of the finest in the country's intellectual communities. It is, in a way, my home, my academic home. I come here to meet my great fellow professors, my colleagues, and my students. And each time I leave enriched by their knowledge, by their humanity, and by their curiosity. And now what about our guest tonight, Ezekiel? I love him. I fear him, but I love him. I admire him, and I fear him. I admire him because of his extraordinary visions filled with anguish and death, but also because of his passion for truth and his love of and for Jerusalem. Though he doesn't live there. He is in exile. He is the prophet of exile. He's in Babylon, far away from Jerusalem, but Jerusalem is in him. He doesn't dwell in the holy city, but the holy city dwells in him with its citizens and their dreams. Isn't this true of many of us who love his words and are amazed by their imagery? We are in Boston and dream of Jerusalem, which remains in our memory with its melancholy exaltation. Ezekiel, a prophet unlike any other, but couldn't this be said of all others? Each and everyone is in his own way, each in his and her own way, are endowed with some particular power and style. What are Ezekiel's? His life story, his strange visions of death and resurrection. Actually, we have evoked his personality some 50-odd years ago. 40 years or 30, I don't remember. But have we learned everything about him then? No, we cannot. In tales and portraits of such ancient characters, there always are hidden aspects, details, episodes that want us to rediscover. Some prophets deal with the future, others with the past. All observe the present and respond to its problems, iniquities, and aspirations. The princely tone of Isaiah, the lamenting voice of Jeremiah, the mystical fantasy of Ezekiel. What do they have in common? All spoke on behalf of the Almighty, obeying his orders. Most of his emissaries initially performed their task against their will, including Moses. They did not want to be prophets. A real prophet, a true prophet, is a prophet against his own will. And most of his emissaries initially performed their task, therefore, and were punished unjustly. What about Ezekiel? Rashi and Abrabanel, Don Yitzchak Abrabanel, and even Spinoza were fascinated by Ezekiel, but fascinated by his language and its hidden, brutal, strange message. But the book as such inspired both admiration and skepticism. Some commentators expressed doubt about its author. Was it Ezekiel alone who wrote it? Others went further and asked, did it exist at all? Is what exists a book simply a volume? On a pragmatic level, it is more a collection of essays, prophecies, memories, and even hallucinations. Of his biography, we know only essentials. The period when he began preaching, his surroundings in Babylon, and of course, again, his hallucinations. Unlike most, if not all, of his peers, the 6th century prophet Ezekiel, son of Buzi the priest, the Kohen, was actively, always active outside the land of Israel. His prophecy conceived in Babylon during the reign of Zedekiah, who was succeeded by King Jehoiachin, was addressed to the people in Jerusalem. He believed that when it is suffering, it is always because of its sins. No pain, no suffering, no death come to humanity if the humanity itself is without sins. When Jews in the thousands were expelled to faraway Babylon, Ezekiel was part of them. Perhaps that is why he appealed so deeply and powerfully to my generation, particularly the generation of survivors. Where is Ezekiel today? Whose voice is his? And if I may usurp a formula from our political questionnaire, are we better off today than our forefathers were in his time? Is the ethical atmosphere cleaner? Are people deeply more motivated to follow ethical demands concerning human relations? Romans had speakers, Greeks philosophers, but we Jews had our prophets. The last witnessed the burning of the temple, and prophecy, we are told, vanished with the destruction of Jerusalem. No more prophetic voice was heard. Is it because they were too sad, too demanding? Is it because their message would have been too tragic, too depressing, psychologically perhaps unbearable? Is this why in our time, filled with major events, some of them eschatological, linking Auschwitz to the national rebirth of our people, history did not produce powerful prophetic guides, teaching us adequate lessons and showing proper ways of and towards redemption? All these questions have followed my reading and rereading the drama-filled book of Ezekiel. As always, answers are hard to find. But here we feel obligated to repeat our conviction that they are waiting for us at the end of time, as we say, teku, when the prophet Elijah will come and he will give us all the answers. Well, no prophet was endowed with such vision. No other vision was so extreme. No man has shed such light on the future, for no other light was so forceful in tearing darkness apart. But then no one had ever seen such darkness, the total darkness that precedes the breaking of dawn. Ezekiel. Who has not heard of this intriguing and passionate speaker whose visions of horror and beauty have left an imprint on innumerable generations? No messenger has hurt us more. None has offered us such confidence. When he is harsh, he seems pitiless. When he is kind, his warmth spills over. In his worst outbursts, he declares his own nation ugly and repugnant. But suddenly he recovers his compassion, and everything and everyone radiate sunshine and serenity. He oscillates between the shame of sin and the grandeur of salvation. And for him, there is nothing in between. So Ezekiel is the man of extremes. He goes from ecstasy of the chariot, hidden, mysterious, mystical Merkava, to the terror of dry bones in the desert. Let's read together. And I looked, says Ezekiel, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud and fire unfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof, as the color of amber, out of the midst of the fire. Also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of man, and everyone had four faces, and everyone had four wings. What are those human and animal creatures, both monstrous and divine, that have appeared on our small, orderly planet? What do these extraterrestrial beings try to achieve in our midst? What is the purpose of their visit, we ask, when we read the book of Ezekiel? And he says, their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot. And they had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides. And they too had their faces and their wings, and their wings were joined one to another. It reads like a feverish dream, if not a nightmare. All those human and inhuman masks intertwined, fragmented images, halting sentences, deafening shouts, and soft whispers, words and silences are being used to describe that which defies description, a realm where heaven and earth merge into one element, combining fire and crystal, fear and joy, the first and last memory of man facing his destiny. The likeness of man, the likeness of lions and eagles, the likeness of firmament, the likeness of the throne, has Ezekiel seen, really seen all that? Has God really chosen to show him all he conceals from all others? If so, why? Why Ezekiel? What made him so special, so singular? Has really God decided to make him special? Why? What made him so special? All the questions raised with respect to prophecy and prophets, the elements of compulsion and the divine mission, the unpredictability of the prophet's response are even more valid as they pertain to Ezekiel. What had he done to deserve to speak in God's name? Why are his words burning with so much anger and then with so much deep affection? There are in his book and his vocabulary themes, subjects, expressions that can be found nowhere else. For instance, he eats his words. He mentions heart transplants, hearts of flesh instead of stone. The poetic term Ben Adam, son of man, is used so often, with such frequency, that it almost becomes his surname. And also he is the prophet to speak of the synagogue as a Mikdash Me'at, a miniature temporary temple. Has he seen the real one? Only in his imagination. But his description far away from Jerusalem is so real, so vivid, that it's a jewel in itself. Ezekiel, the prophet of imagination, more than his peer Jeremiah, he imagined both exile and redemption in ways that made them both tangible. More important, he was the first to speak of Kiddush Hashem, of Israel's privilege and awesome obligation to sanctify the Lord's name. In other words, to speak of martyrdom. From his exile, Ezekiel speaks to all generations, and particularly to ours. For more than his own contemporaries, we have witnessed the frailty of social structures and the irresistible power of spiritual courage and lofty dreams. For once upon a time, some of us did indeed use a deserted land covered with dry bones. And yes, we could testify to man's ability to transform memories of tragedy into necessary, unavoidable hope. Indeed, no generation can understand Ezekiel as well, as profoundly as ours. Just read the text itself. Vayehi bishloshim shana, and it came to pass in the 30th year, in the 4th month, in the 5th day of the month, I was then in exile, or among the exiled, the captives, by the rivers of Chebar, when suddenly the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. Clearly, the story opens in the manner of a chronicle. The style is precise. The chronicler does not want the reader to be confused. Thus, we know what happened, and where, and when, and to whom. Hayo hayad varad Hashem el Yecheskel ben Buzi ha-Kohen, says the text. The word of God came to Ezekiel, son of Buzi the priest, while being in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Chebar. And the hand of God was laid upon him. And va'ere vehine, I looked, he said, I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north. No other prophet had that language. But not look yet, not yet. We have not finished with the opening statement, which presents certain problems. The story begins in the first person, va'ani, and I, and then jumps to the third, va'teni, va'tehi, alav, and returns to the first va'ere. I, he said, in the beginning, and all of a sudden the I becomes a third person. The prophet has just been contacted by God, and he's still shaken by the experience. Most prophets had similar reactions. Prophecy was thrust upon them, always. Couldn't God speak more gently to his chosen? Apparently not. Prophecy always began with a shock. Is this why Ezekiel suddenly left reality and moved into a world of fantasy? The historian has been turned into a visionary. Is this why, unlike Jeremiah or Jonah or Moses, he did not resist the call? All the prophets resisted. They always said, not me, don't take me, take him. Not he. He did not resist. He accepted. Leaving time and reason behind, he looked and saw chariots of fire, strange beasts, and half human, half divine creatures. He looked and saw what exists outside or above or before creation. How is one to explain the abrupt change? The man who just one passage earlier insists on clarity and precision has allowed his mind to wander so much so that he forgets to tell us something that may be of essential importance. Didn't he say God spoke to him? Then why doesn't he tell us what God said? Just like that, he doesn't. He does not tell us what he heard because he is too busy describing what he saw. And what he saw is so unreal that those of us who dwell in reality are forbidden to follow his gaze and look or even speak about it. Listen to the Mishnah in the treatise of Chagiga. Ein doshim barayot bishlosha. One must not debate with three students questioning about intimate relations between men and women. I know so many of us disobey. Then he says, Velo b'maase breshit b'shnayim. Nor is one supposed to discuss the mysteries of creation with two students. Velo b'merkava b'yachid. Nor are we supposed to discuss the mystery of the chariot with just one student. This last reference is once again to the visions that Prophet Ezekiel had in Babylon in the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity. The Merkava, the chariot experiences, are forbidden territory, dangerous to outsiders. One cannot approach them with impunity. Why should the mystery of creation be considered less perilous than that of the chariot? Maimonides comments, the first is about creation, the second about its creator. Creation is imminent and therefore perceivable. The creator is not. Gershom Scholem, the great scholar of mysticism, quotes an ancient text of the Holocaust literature, or the Heichalot literature, that warned us against trespassing mystical frontiers, and I quote him. If a person was unworthy to see the king in his beauty, the angels at the gate disturbed his senses and confused him. And when they said to him, come in, he entered, and instantly they pressed him and threw him into the fiery lava stream. And at the gate of the sixth of seven palaces, it seemed as though hundreds of thousands and millions of waves of water stormed against him, and yet there was not a drop of water. But he, the visitor, asked the angels, what is the meaning of these waters? And they began to stone him. Wretched! Do you not see with your own eyes? Are you perhaps a descendant of those who kissed the golden calf? And thus are unworthy to see the king in his beauty, and they struck him with iron bars and wounded him. In other words, not only are we not able to understand Ezekiel's chariot visions, but we are not even allowed to make them an object of scholarly analysis. Why? What is so special about what Ezekiel saw? And why had he alone permitted to see it? Now, who was he? What information is there about his life and work? We know that he was a priest, that he traveled a lot and spoke a lot, that his command of language was both disturbing and enchanting. And what else? We know his mannerism, his style, his remarkable courage. Or was it naivete in using repetition? Examples. The expression son of man, which sounds so good, appears 100 times in the book. Then, Adoshem, Adoshem, O Lord, appears 200 times Vayaduki ani Adoshem they shall know that I am the Lord 50 times. Gilulim, idolatry, only 39 times. Didn't he have an editor? What was his nationality? Was he a Palestinian prophet sent by God to Babylon? Was he a Babylonian immigrant from Palestine who returned to Palestine? Some sources say he was one of the other or the other. Some texts claim he was both or neither. From the text itself, we gather that he had been exiled together with his king and the king's court to Babylon. We know the exact location of his dwelling, Tel Aviv, on the river Chebar. Babylonian sources tell us that Tel Aviv or Tel Abib referred to ruins from before the floods. In our literature, the name fares somewhat better. We are told that Tel Aviv was in ancient times the largest Jewish city in the diaspora. Today it's in Israel. Its population then was 10,000 souls. They spoke Hebrew, and they were prosperous and respected. And we are also told that they observed the Jewish law. For Ezekiel, we know that he began to prophesy 6 or 7 years before Jerusalem's final tragedy, and that he continued for another 12 to 15 years. Was he married? Yes. His wife died of the plague, and he saw in her death a prefiguration of the destruction of Jerusalem. So affected was he that for a while he lost his power of speech, suffering from aphasia. Did he have brothers, friends, allies? We don't know. We do know that he had enemies, that he has been established clearly as the enemy of his enemies. Like most prophets, he constantly provoked anger and hostility. Some of his adversaries ridiculed him by saying, "Who is he anyway to talk the way he does? Isn't he a descendant of that woman of ill repute, you know, Rahab, the harlot who made Jericho famous?" Like Jeremiah, he used pantomime to promulgate his views and fears. When he warned the people of Gilgal of the coming exile, he paraded through the streets carrying a knapsack, thus telling them that they too would become wanderers. At twilight, he would dig a hole in the wall and steal out into the darkness like a fugitive, a refugee. Like Jeremiah, he must have felt that he would not die in the Holy Land. Jeremiah was buried in Egypt and Ezekiel in Babylon. Iraqi Jews thought they knew the location of his grave and came to pray there, imploring him to intercede on their behalf. Yes, Ezekiel endured much torment and agony throughout his life. No wonder that God felt the need to repeatedly encourage and comfort him, telling him not to worry, not to heed his critics, not to be heard by their mockery, to speak up even if his words were to fall on deaf ears, even if his mission were to bring no immediate results. As a prophet, he was not free to choose either to speak or remain silent. He was told when to make himself visible and when to remain invisible. From the book itself, we receive the script God prepared for his emissary Ezekiel, his order to stay 7 days under house arrest, alone, yes, to illustrate loneliness. The effect on him is obvious. He becomes harsh, demanding, unyielding, misanthropic. Naturally, Ezekiel became a perfect subject for psychoanalysts. Some experts called him psychotic. Others left it at pathological. One analyst found that our prophet had catatonic periods, quote unquote, which resulted from his paranoia tendencies. Want to hear more? Here are more diagnoses. Narcissistic, masochistic conflicts. Fantasies of castration. unconscious sexual regression, schizophrenia, delusions of persecution, delusions of grandeur. All that is in texts about him. His sermons have the quality and the urgency of eyewitness reporting. Mindful of every detail, he tells us what is going on in God's favorite dwelling place. In short, it reminds him of Sodom, for which the key word is toeva, abomination, the physical and more moral prostitution, social decadence, intellectual deprivation. One could produce an entire encyclopedia of sin just using Ezekiel's vocabulary. He's particularly severe with the leaders. We are informed of what they are saying, thinking, doing, plotting inside and outside the sanctuary. Are there no good people in the land, you would wonder? No just men left? He speaks of the elders who in exasperation began to wonder whether God had not abandoned his people altogether. I quote, "And the glory of God said unto me, said Ezekiel, son of man, look and see what they are doing in my house, to my house. See the great abominations. Look well, and you will notice for even greater ones." Old leaders and priests now worship idols, he says. Listen to the language, son of man. Have you seen what the ancients of the house of Israel do in the dark? Or in the secret chambers of their imagination. They say to themselves, anything is permitted, for God cannot see us. He has forsaken his land and abandoned its inhabitants. But that is not all, says God. Is that possible? Look, says God, and you will see worse. And then, quote, he brought me to the door of the temple, of the temple's gate, and behold, there were women weeping for the idol Tammuz. Wait, says God to Ezekiel, there is even worse. And he took me inside the inner court, and between the porch and the altar, I saw about 25 men with their backs to the temple, worshipping the sun. And this is God showing him all that. And then God uses an expression that reminded Ezekiel and us of Noah and the floods. Kimalu et ha'aretz chamas. Strange, terrible. They filled the land with violence. And that was the worst. As long as people offended heaven, God, in spite of his anger, was willing to wait. But when they ceased to be human towards one another, he had to intervene and punish them. Few prophets have ever spoken with such despair. To the inhabitants of Jerusalem, he says that they will be defeated. To those in Babylon, he says that their deliverance is not near. Where is hope in all that? Where is consolation in all that? Of course, like most prophets, he emphasizes a cycle of sin, punishment, and redemption. But according to him, redemption is far, far away. Redemption seems improbable, if not impossible. Why does the prophet insist with such fervor on Jewish weaknesses and transgressions? Does he enjoy shaming the Jews? One reason may be that knowing of the catastrophe in the making, he wants the Jewish people to have an explanation. He wants to save them from absurdity. Better than they think their plight represents punishment than gratuitous cruelty. Any answer may be better than no answer. So now we must ask ourselves, why is it that it was so? Was Israel really that bad, that sinful? Open the book of history and turn to the pages. Though a vassal state to Babylon, Judea enjoyed internal freedom. After a short reign of some 100 days, King Jehoiachin and his entourage, together with skilled technicians in the thousands, had been deported to Babylon, leaving behind a newly appointed king, a weakling named Zedekiah or Sedekias. Pressured by Egypt and Phoenicians to rebel against Babylon, Zedekias finally gave up his position of comfortable neutrality and allow these militant advisors to move the nation into war. The enemy emperor Nebuchadnezzar dispatched his army and thus began the military siege of Jerusalem. Judea's spiritual leaders, the four prophets, Jeremiah, Uriah, son of Shemaiah, Habakkuk, and Ezekiel, tried hard to change the mood in vain. Uriah was beheaded, Jeremiah jailed, Ezekiel persecuted and humiliated. And yet in the Gentile world, culture is flourishing. Athenians build the Acropolis and celebrate a philosopher named Thales of Miletus, Aesop's fables, Aeschylus' dramas, and the oracles at Delphi. The Chinese enjoy the wisdom of Lao Tse. The Maya built temples in Mexico. World history is moving forward in waves of upheaval. The various emperors, forever dissatisfied with what they possess, forever aspiring to enlarge their empires. Somehow Judea is always caught in the middle of the political and strategic designs. Egypt and Babylon are enemies, and again both need Judea. Strange. All the empires of the times seem not to need Judea. And eventually all will vanish with the exception of Judea. The Chaldeans, the Assyrians, the Phoenicians, the Persians, the Egyptians, the Romans all had to withdraw from Judea. Judea alone remained in Judea. Most prophets found it necessary to address themselves to other nations as well as to Judea. Just as Jeremiah was called Navila Goyim, a prophet to Gentile nations, Ezekiel too could be classified as a prophet to the enemy nations. For not only did he predict the destruction of Israel, he also foretold the doom of Tyre and Egypt. Ezekiel came forth with his vision of dry bones. And that chapter is especially fascinating to us. The dry bones. In the Jewish tradition, one may not rejoice over an enemy's downfall. The enemy's punishment offers no consolation to the victim. The victim's rehabilitation and victory and redemption must not be linked to other people's suffering. The theme, the purpose, call it the message in Ezekiel's sermons, is not victory, but repentance. If the sinner repents, he will live. If he does not, he will die. It is in Ezekiel's book that we find the poignant verse, Va'omar lach bedamai chayi, and I shall tell you, you shall live in thy blood. In thy blood you shall live. In thy blood, not in your enemies. Did Ezekiel succeed? He tried hard. Obeying God's orders to the letter, he went so far as to do supernatural things. While staying in Babylon, he flew, quote unquote, back and forth to Jerusalem. He inspected the celestial chariot, described events hidden in the future, and subjected himself to humiliation and ridicule, never complaining about his own ordeal. When he himself enters the story, we are moved. Jeremiah spoke of captives. Ezekiel referred to refugees. And he became one himself, suspected by everyone, resented for being on God's side, for knowing too much, for protesting against false prophets and false comfort. Whatever he predicted for others ultimately happened to him too. His book is the only one of those of the prophets that almost fell victim to censorship. For a while, the book of Ezekiel was in danger of not being published. Why such discrimination? Because of his unmitigated criticism of his people? No. Others have been as frank and as daring. Then why? Some Talmudic sages maintain that there are passages in Ezekiel that are in conflict with the Torah. Others reproach him for dealing with forbidden mystical themes. For example, it came to pass that in the house of a teacher, a Jewish child opened the book of Ezekiel and began studying the story of the fire and the chariot, and soon a fire came out of the fire and burned the child down. So the sages envisaged to suppress the book of Ezekiel altogether. Some critics do object to his frankness. They would have preferred him to indulge in some kind of cover-up. About the sins of Jerusalem? No. A cover-up of the heavenly secrets. He had visions good for him, but why reveal them to others? He saw the heavenly chariot and its strange creatures. Why did he have to boast about it? Why couldn't he have locked his impressions in his memory for later? The fact that Ezekiel could not resist telling the story and what a story it was hurt his image in certain Talmudic circles. One commentator states, tongue-in-cheek, actually, to diminish him, quote, any maidservant saw while crossing the Red Sea more than what Ezekiel would see later in heaven. What is clear from these stories is the resentment of some sages toward Ezekiel for having revealed his visions. But then, isn't he a prophet? Isn't the prophet duty-bound not to keep anything to himself? Isn't he an instrument of communication between God and mankind? Clearly, nothing in his life is private. All he has, all he is, belong to both God and his people. His fears and hopes, his joys and depressions, his moments of turmoil and his moments of ecstasy, they are not his alone. A prophet has no ego. A prophet has no individual memory. If he hears a voice, he must echo it. If he sees visions, he must share them, right? Yes and no, yes, as far as the voices are concerned. When God speaks, the prophet becomes his vessel. But visions, that is something else. God rarely says, tell them what you see, but rather tell them what you hear. Then why did Ezekiel choose to go beyond his mission? Mind you, it was not transgression on his part. God has not told him not to speak of his visions. But why was his book placed in jeopardy? Says the Talmud, we must remember with gratitude the good Hananiah, son of Hizkiah. For were it not for his intervention, the book of Ezekiel would have been put away forever. So who was Hananiah, son of Hizkiah, who fought so valiantly for freedom of expression? It is in his home that the sharper conflicts were conflicted and resolved. The 18-point program, which was exceptionally adopted as the students of Shammai outvoted those of Hillel, had been discussed in his attic. He was clearly a man for impossible missions. When some of his colleagues openly complained that the book of Ezekiel contained passages that contradicted the Torah, he ordered for his attic enough food and candles to last until all discrepancies were clarified, and they were. For instance, in the Torah it's clearly stated in the name of Moses that God, Pokei Davod Albanim, God is vindictive, is visiting the iniquities of the father upon his children and his children's children, says Rabbi Yosei, son of Hanina. Ezekiel unashamedly challenged Moses' view by flatly declaring, behold, all souls are mine, says the Lord, just as the soul of the father, so also the son. Only the soul that sins will die. Moses speaks of hereditary guilt. Ezekiel stresses individual responsibility. Generally speaking, one senses that Ezekiel disturbed both his contemporaries and their learned descendants. From the fact that his book was to be subjected to quasi-censorship, we can deduce that our sages had problems with the author as well. His interpretation of Moses' laws is only one element in the equation. There must have been others. Talmudic scholars had problems with Ezekiel, who apparently had problems with God. First, he was jealous. Of whom? Of his fellow prophets. At one point, he exclaimed, Master of the universe, I am not a priest. Am I not a priest? Am I not a prophet? Why did Isaiah speak for you in Jerusalem while I must do the same thing in exile? But then God too had problems with him. When God asked his prophet, Hati yena ha-tzamot ha-yeveshot ha-elu, will these dry bones come back to life? He paused a little, obviously waiting for an answer. And when it came, it was evasive. Instead of shouting, yes, they will, they must, for they and we need your miracle, Ezekiel became a politician. He adopted a non-committal attitude. He was too skeptical. He said, maybe, who knows, you know, I don't. And that is why, says the Talmud, Ezekiel was condemned to die, not in the Holy Land, but in Babylon. Another legend is even more disturbing. It came to pass that King Nebuchadnezzar ordered all his subjects in all the lands under his rule to worship one of his idols. Lest they all be executed, 3 representatives were chosen from each nation to act on behalf of their people, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They represented the children of Israel. They turned to their teacher Daniel for advice. Daniel, in his humility, sent them to Ezekiel, who urged them to reject martyrdom and choose flight instead. They disregarded his suggestion, saying that they wished to die as martyrs. Still, Ezekiel persisted in trying to dissuade them from becoming martyrs. And when they still refused to listen, he came up with yet another proposal, that they should withhold their decision until he received word from God that he would save them through a miracle. And God's answer was no. Nevertheless, the 3 just men refused to escape or to bow to the king's will. When Ezekiel, in despair, burst into tears, God at last offered him a consolation, saying, do not worry, they will be saved. I will save them from the burning furnace. But then why couldn't he have told him so beforehand? Only to allow their fate and their martyrdom to appear more glorious. Good for them, but what about Ezekiel? His part in the drama is less enviable than theirs. He is made to sound weak and frightened. Instead of telling the 3 martyrs to be strong, he wanted them to run fast. However, Talmudic sages have their way of balancing reticence by giving praise to the prophet's wild powers. How? He became instrumental in saving the 3 just men's life. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were about to die in the Babylonian furnace when Ezekiel performed the miracle of resurrecting the dry bones. The miracle encompassed more than those directly concerned. Earlier martyrs too were resurrected and rejoined the living community of Israel. Do you know how King Nebuchadnezzar learned of Ezekiel's miracles? He had a drinking vessel made of the bones of a slain Jew, and he was about to use it and drink from its wine when life began to stir in the vessel, and one bone struck the king in the face, and a voice was heard proclaiming, a friend of this man is right now reviving the dead. Did he really? As always, Talmudic opinions are divided. Some say yes, he did. Some go so far as identifying the resurrected, if not by name, at least by origin and category. Those Jews, for instance, who in their impatience escaped from Egypt before Moses led the whole people out of bondage, or those who ironically did not believe in the resurrection of death, or the young Judeans taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar, whose beauty drove Babylonian women mad. Under pressure from their husbands, the emperor ordered the young Judeans killed, and now they were brought back to life by Ezekiel. All these possibilities were examined during a heated session of one of the academies because of some skeptics who dared to state publicly that, in their opinion, the entire story of the famous dry bones was nothing but a figment of biblical imagination. Or to use their language, Mashal Haya. It was nothing but a parable. Actually, the debate dealt with larger and more general issues. What would happen to tzaddikim, to just men in the long run, after they reached paradise? Would they die again? Of course, here two opinions were divided. Some said yes, they will die, but their death will be painless. And they quote the case of the dry bones. Those men whom Ezekiel brought back to life died right away, but they didn't suffer. At which point someone got up and said, "What nonsense, the story is fiction." And thus went the discussion, said Rabbi Eliezer. The dead that were resurrected by Ezekiel stood up, praised the Lord, and died. Someone wanted to know the nature of the praise. Said Rabbi Yeshua, they sang, "Ad Hashem meimito mechaye." The Lord causes people to die and return to life. And then another sage interjected a brief weeping remark. "All this emet mashal haya," he said. "All this was a true parable." Rabbi Nechemya slept. "Really? How is that possible? If it's true, it's not a parable. If it's a parable, it wasn't true." And the answer, "Be'emet mashal haya." It was truly a parable. Would you say that the debate had exhausted its logical or illogical possibilities? That really occurs rarely in the Talmud. Rabbi Nechemya had hardly finished his linguistic contributions when Rabbi Eliezer, son of Yose of Galilee, made his own opinion known. He opposed the view that the dead were resurrected only to die again right away. "Oh no," he said. "They made Aliyah to the land of Israel. And there they got married and had children." An audacious thought, Rabbi Yehuda ben Breita was more audacious. "True," he said, "they made Aliyah, and I am their descendant." Obviously, the episode preoccupied them to an astonishing degree. Remember the setting, a place where Judea, last king Zedekiah, made his last stand against Babylonian armies. The plain is now covered with the mutilated bodies of fallen Jewish warriors, and it is there, in the midst of climactic cruelty, desolation, and mourning, that Ezekiel has his most glorious and breathtaking vision, the vision of the dry bones. And that vision, if it wasn't true then, was surely true later on. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard the first of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled, In the Bible, Ezekiel and His Vision of Our Time. Professor Wiesel was introduced by Boston University President Robert Brown. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.